Move over math and science, make room for grit and perseverance. Do we really need to teach these skills? Andre Perry says no and will explain why. Our activist of the week is a very special and personal look at the life of legendary activist Howard Zinn through friend and former neighbor Matt Damon's mom. We will check trending news and of course have a moment of Zinn. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker and Dr. Jed Hopkins. It's time to take a look at the top trending news stories in education.
You know it's testing season when the bullying starts. Jed, as we talked about last time, it was the opt-outs. You know, we were talking about opt-out, and there was a group saying that we should opt in and take tests. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, again, the opt-out movement is a movement that's running across the country where parents, teachers, activists are saying, look, no to high-stakes tests, right?
Right.
Okay. They're horrible things. What also happens at this time of year, which some people don't realize, is the bullying that comes in response to you as a parent or you as a student or you as a teacher promoting, activating, participating in opt-out.
Yeah.
So for what we get, for example, are superintendents making statements to teachers like, you'll be fired if you talk about opt-out to your students, okay, has never happened. Or the teacher that is now frightened by the superintendents that will then tell the children that if they don't do well or if they opt out, they will somehow hurt the teacher, they won't move on to the next grade.
Yeah. You know what? You said it's bullying, and that's a really good word for it. And you know, there's something about bullies. Usually, not always, but usually the bullies are people who have been bullied.
Right.
And who's bullying the administration?
Well, and that's let's look at this. These are politicians coming after the administrators. But I tell you what, there is no excuse, though, when we talk about schools as, quote, bully-free zones, which if you walk into most of them, they'll all say that now. The idea that administrators, superintendents, and even teachers are participating in bullying opt-out students, this is unacceptable behavior. And in fact, the idea that you can be held back, which is one of the ways they frighten people, you won't go on to the next grade or you won't graduate. In New Jersey, a judge just ruled that using a high stakes test as a graduation requirement and taking a student who opts out of it and telling them they can't graduate is absolutely illegal.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk.
You can read his work in the Hechinger Report and The Root. You can hear him on the radio in New Orleans. He's the founding dean of urban education at Davenport University. Welcome, Andre Perry, to Busted Pencils. Andre, supporters of the Every Student Succeeds Act are now promoting the requirement of teaching soft skills such as grit, perseverance, and diligence. Andre, you're crying foul on this. Why?
One, I believe that low-income students inherently have grit, perseverance, and all these other tangibles because they have to. Folks who live in conditions that many of us could not do, because the irony is that folks of privilege are the ones who lack the grit. They could never live in and walk in the shoes of some of our students. Nevertheless, we're literally constantly fixing students instead of fixing the policies and the larger socio-political environment that cause children to have stress and to limit their opportunity to get to college or a job. And so my argument is that, you know, kids have grit. Grit's not propelling upper-income students to colleges. It's the income. It's where they live, the school they go to. Let's not forget that the greatest predictors of academic success still are things like prior achievement, what kind of school you go to, where do you live, your parents' educational levels. These are still the major factors. And, you know, it's not grit. And moreover, I just think that if you are you have a good teacher, grit, perseverance, all these things are baked in the lesson. Mm-hmm. We don't teach lessons where we're just pouring information in a kid's head and not teaching the intangibles. No, we teach the intangibles as we go along. So this idea of grit, it's just another trendy thing that advocates our responsibility for dealing with the larger policy issues that really hinder our children.
Well, I wanted to point this out. This is a direct quote from your piece in The Root. You say, quote, "It is racism that really keeps students out of college and careers, not a child's lack of resilience and for a matter of fact, grit," you would say. That's deep, though, right there. Now, so racism, we have to deal with racism?
Oh, absolutely. One, remember, it wasn't that long ago, pre-Brown v. Board, where our segregated communities and schools limited opportunities for generations of folks. But even currently, our inability to fund schools properly, adequately, still limits, and it's still based on property taxes that is rooted in a segregated racist structure. And so every day we deal with the vestiges of discrimination in our school system. And so until we're willing to change funding structures, change the way we attract teacher talent, until we really deal with community wellness, all these other things just are, distractions from us really getting at those substantive matters that really impact student achievement. And I can't say this enough. We just assume that people's academic achievement is based on their resilience. No, it is not. There are lots of folks that I would gladly trade their home, their car, their income for in exchange for what lack of grit our students have. Our families would love those intangibles and have their kids go into college soft. But the reality is income, parent, educational levels, where you go to school, the types of teachers you have, these things are more important.
You even go further and talk about, soft skills and being, you call them bootstrapping, which, this is, again, your words are very powerful and I like them. It insidiously blames youth for failing in racist systems that was designed to block their success. But then you go on to say, and it absolves the middle class of any responsibility to uproot inequality. So in that statement there, too, though, you're leaning at the idea, okay, first of all, if resilience and grit is a distractor and hides us, in fact, it actually creates a deficit model. What's this introduction, though, of the middle class and their responsibility to do something for it? What would they do?
There's this whole idea, one, that it's the kid's fault. A lot of these concepts that come about periodically, they're not necessarily wrong, but they're framed and corrupted by this idea that black kids need fixing. And there couldn't be anything further from the truth. So what I mean, what middle-class folks can do when it really comes down to how we fund education, we're constantly blocking any substantive means to increase the amount of revenue so that low-income communities can have a shot at a decent education. Here in New Orleans, lots of our upper-income people have second, third homes. They rent out. They jack up the rent. What if we increase taxes on second and third homes? Mm-hmm. What would our school system look like? And in places, particularly places like New Orleans, where we're number one in the nation in terms of the percentage of private schools, and we can get tax breaks for sending our kids to private school, there is no incentive to do any kind of collective good. And so, it becomes as easy to say, hey, look at those kids over there that can't get it together. They don't have the intangibles. They don't have eye contact. As if, and I say this in one of the pieces, in the piece, as if proper eye contact created the health disparities and bad policing and unemployment. Like not having a belt on really causes you to not have algebra, I mean, or physics or AP courses in your class. You know, these things are silly. They're distractions, they're silly, but they're all rooted in this bootstrapping ethic that is dyed in the wool in American culture. And we just got to stop it. And more importantly, we can't be ashamed just to demand justice. Too often in our schools and in life, black folk, brown folk are almost ashamed to say, I deserve certain accommodations. The issue of the poison water in Flint, it really made things clear. There's no eye contact soft skills that's going to correct the poison people have taken in over time. But just like water is a need, good schools are a need. Public safety is a need. But we don't look at it in the same way. But folks need to demand clean water, safe streets, good schools, all these things that propel people to a middle-class lifestyle.
You're listening to Busted Pencils, Fully Leaded Education Talk. We're talking to Andre Perry.
You've got a really powerful message, and it's not the kids that need fixing. It's the institution that needs fixing. Who's listening to this?
Well, I actually think more and more people are listening to it because, the more we put up examples of how silly these ideas are in the face of what kids go through, they're starting to look just foolish. And again, I think the Flint water crisis put things into perspective, but also the efforts in the criminal justice system are starting to put things in perspective. The advocates in the criminal justice system are not saying, pull your pants up anymore. They're saying, you know what, change three strikes. Let's get rid of these mandatory sentencing laws. Let's change the very structures that get people in trouble in the first place. And so when you have that example, it becomes hard, and it becomes almost this very myopic when you're saying, let's teach grit, when schools are underfunded, they don't have the types of courses that would even give them a shot at college, and folks are unemployed. I mean, we need real human capital good, and I just think that the more and more people put up these very privileged middle class, upper middle class ideas, the more they fall on their faces as being coming from a privileged set. That, and in this case, folks who could never walk in the shoes of children are now promoting grit.
Right.
It's silly. It is absolutely silly.
Okay. So
and I say this again, there are things around perseverance, resilience, self-efficacy. All of these things have a long-standing background in research and in psychology and a number of other fields. I'm not discounting that these things don't exist and they're not important, but they're not what's causing folks to not get in college. I mean, it's not a lack of grit that's preventing black men and boys and girls and Latinas and Latinos from getting into college. It is not.
Okay, so 1 minute, Andre. Here's the question for you.
Mm-hmm.
If we're not going to teach grit and perseverance, what should we be teaching? Now, I know you talked about systemic racism and different things like that, but what about a teacher who's listening to this show and says, okay, Andre, I want to teach. What should I teach?
Teach your subject well. If you teach algebra to an eighth grader well, they will get persistence and grit. If you're teaching calculus, they will get persistence and grit. If you, if in the lower grades, If you're teaching these basic subjects in a very rigorous manner, you're making it relevant, you are differentiating instruction, you're doing what you would do in a middle class or upper middle class environment, they will get what they need. And so that's all I'm asking. But more importantly, educators have to connect to other sectors. This day of it's all about the school or nothing else is ridiculous. Let's get at the root causes of what's stressing kids out and making them depressed and making them vulnerable and less likely to go to college. And when we do that, when we eradicate these issues, guess what? They'll get to college.
Andre Perry, thank you so much for your wisdom, your words, your power on Busted Pencils.
Absolutely. Keep busting those pencils, man.
I will do my best.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk.
Each week we close the show with a tribute to legendary historian and activist Howard Zinn. Few people knew and experienced Howard the way our friend Matt Damon's mom did. So this week we find out what Matt Damon's mom thinks about Howard Zinn.
Wait, what? You want to know what my mom would say? All right, well, just ask her.
A part of your past is the fact that, and we have a segment called A Moment of Zinn, where we talk about Howard Zinn, and you knew Howard quite well. In fact, you were neighbors?
Yes, I moved next door to Howard and his wife, Roz, many years ago. That would be like 1972 or 3, and something like that. And we became very good friends, but Howard and I actually became best friends. And for many years, that's what we said. We were best friends, and we hung out together. Can you imagine hanging out with Howard Zinn? I was a young person really eager to understand many things about politics, economics, international issues and things. And, you know, we just spent a lot of time talking about the world. And I learned so much from him. Howard was really, really critical in shaping me, what I think, who I am. He's a very moral person. He understood that morality was critical in making decisions about things in the world, that it wasn't just that you're smart. He understood a lot of people are smart, but they do many things that hurt others and are bad for, you know, for the world. And he thought that moral orientation was really a key in being a person who was going to move towards social justice and make the world a better place. But Howard Zinn was also somebody who could have a really good time.
Okay, because I was going to ask you about the, you know, were there, you know, backyard deck parties in which Howard Zinn and Matt Damon's mom and a young Matt Damon are hanging out?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
What's
Howard
that like?
Zinn and Matt Damon's mom and Matt Damon and Kyle Damon, we hung out. We hung out in the backyard. And we cooked out and we sat at the picnic table and we laughed and laughed, because the thing about Howard that you might not know is, of anyone I've known in my entire life, Howard had the most extraordinary sense of humor. A sentence didn't go by without Howard turning into something funny. And he was the most creative person with humor I've ever encountered. And I used to try to study how does he do that, but I couldn't ever understand it. It was so original. And you could just be having a normal conversation and he'd somehow flip it upside down and make it funny and kind of transformational in the process. But Howard never made fun of other people. He didn't criticize other people. Actually, he was a person, an enormously generous soul. He really did not spend time criticizing other people. He focused on the positive. I can't tell you how positive that man was. No matter what, he stayed positive and really believed in people and really believed in social change and really believed that people were capable of understanding what the world needs and making the world better and changing their views if they heard the information they needed to hear. It's enormously positive, but such a fun person to be around. You're always laughing when you're with him, and at the same time, learning a lot.
What about when the boys, like Matt, you know, threw a ball over in his yard, though? Did he keep it?
No, but he actually brought it back. Oh, there's so many funny stories about him. Once I looked out the window, and he was painting his car. He had a little blue Volkswagen, and it had some rust on it, and he had a little can of blue paint, and he was painting it. And then once my son Kyle got locked out of his bedroom, and Howie got a ladder and broke in the window for us. And, oh, no, he played with the kids. I mean, he threw the ball with the kids in the yard. He had a grandson about the same age as my kids, so my kids would go over and play at Howie and Roz's house with their grandson, Will Kabat-Zinn, who's, you know John and Miley Kabat-Zinn?
I do know John Kabat-Zinn, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's Howie's son-in-law.
I did not know that.
So, yeah. So,
he's taught me a lot.
Johnny.
I've read a lot of his mindfulness meditation. I took a full workshop on his meditation techniques.
Yes, I have too. And I took yoga from him. And I'm also very, very fond of Myla, his wife. They're a beautiful family. They have three kids. And so our families all knew each other, and there was a lot of love and respect all the way around. But, you know, I hung out with Howie. We watched Red Sox games. He was a huge Red Sox fan. So we watched baseball games together, and we went oystering together at the Cape. He loved collecting oysters and cleaning them and eating them raw, and that's something he did every single day he could on the Cape. They had a little house in Wellfleet, and, you know, we just spent, and he's a very cultured person. He loved going to theater. He wrote plays also. He loved going to movies. He loved talking about pop culture, too. So he was a very multidimensional person, not just an intellectual, and many people know him, you know, as a serious radical intellectual scholar, which he was. But he was much, much more than that. And then one other thing I'll mention is that he had the most beautiful way of speaking to everyone equally and treating everyone equally. And that's because it truly came from who he was. So a lot of times I went out to lunch with him, and we'd have these long lunches. Sometimes my husband Doug and Roz were with us. Sometimes it's just the two of us. But we were always talking politics because we were all interested in politics. And what would happen is the waiter, this happened many times. A waiter or a female, a waitress, but I'm thinking in particular of one occasion, would be just, you know, pouring the water and serving the food. But the conversation, because of Howie, was so interesting that the person would be standing next to the table for a long time listening instead of carrying on their waiting job. And it was so funny because eventually Howie would include the person in the conversation. Like, what do you think? And bring the person in, and then the person would be participating. Howie was very well known, so when we'd go out to lunch, many times he was recognized.
Sure.
So it was just people wanting to listen to what he had to say. But he was so inclusive. And even when a waiter or waitress would come over at first, he would look at them directly in the face. He would ask them something, or he'd make some joke or something to make a connection. He didn't just order, you know, a fish sandwich. He connected with the human being first.
This is Matt Damon on Busted Pencils Radio. Please stop bothering me and just ask my mom already.
And now, our moment of Zen. The future is an infinite succession of presents, and to live now as we think human beings should live, in defiance of all that is bad around us, is itself a marvelous victory.
Want more Busted Pencils? Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Also, log on to BustedPencils.com to keep up with trending news, hear parts of the show, and nominate an activist of the week. For Jed Hopkins, I'm Tim Slecker, and thanks for Busting Pencils.